Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. All right. I thought a cool place to start would be to talk about your experience and evolution in the hospitality business through like the lens of this diverse portfolio you have. Because one of the things is that's so impressive about your portfolio is you have some commodity-ish type hotels, but then you also have some amazing inspired design hotels in beautiful locations. So maybe you could just talk about how you got into the business and how that's evolved over time to what you're primarily focusing on now.
Yeah, sure, Jake. Happy to. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's kind of graduating to different asset classes, asset types. So I'll start back. So I'll answer your question a little slowly. My parents managed an Econo Lodge Motel in St. Louis, Missouri, actually in a town called Bridgeton, Missouri, where I kind of grew up. We stayed at the motel, you know, and kind of cleaned rooms, ran front desk, help with kind of like the basics and the fundamentals of running a hotel, which is like as basic as possible as an economy lodge in like suburban St. Louis. And that kind of got me in the game, kind of understanding kind of just the basic fundamentals. And then I went to college, and out of college, I didn't know what I wanted to do, like a lot of people, but a lot of folks in my undergrad went and did investment banking. And so I was like, okay, I guess I'll do that. So I worked in investment banking and finance. And I always had some level of interior design, creative, like, you know, kind of creative director type in me. But that at the time, you know, 20 plus years ago, wasn't something you could make a career out of very easily, or it was more risky than just kind of taking a finance job in New York. So I went into finance. I worked in investment banking and then real estate private equity, a lot of times focused on hospitality. And the first projects I would do, frankly, were the ones that were easiest, that kind of made sense. It was a math game. So it was like more of these commoditized hotels, these branded hotel projects, kind of deals that were easier to finance, easier to get a lender to finance, because it's harder to do independent or boutique hotel, the creative stuff that we do now. But that was kind of how I started the business. It was easier to convince investors. It was easier to convince myself that I could take that risk. And it was easier to convince lenders. But eventually what happened is, on one hotel a while ago in New York City, it was a branded hotel, and I saw the rates kind of increasing and increasing and increasing every month. It was like a boom time. This was like 15 years ago. And I'm like, what if we made this an independent hotel? Because I saw a rate ceiling because it was associated with a limited service brand. And so I said, let's take that brand off. And we did a soft brand with one of these with large flags, but it was really independent. And we saw that rate ceiling go away and we were able to make it interesting. And it still wasn't that great of a hotel, but it was better than it was when it was a branded hotel in New York. And so that kind of gave me the taste of kind of this independent boutique hotel space. And so now, you know, really what we do and what we focus on at Bridgeton is kind of that 4-star kind of creative hotels like Maram or Journey or Don Ranch or the Walkers. Those style is what we focus on. The hotels that we have in our portfolio that we still want and love, which are more associated with brands like Indigo or Tapestry Collection or some other things like that. You know, we own those, but they're kind of more legacy hotels for us. And we don't really focus too much on that today. Not that we wouldn't, not that they're not a great project to work on, but building an independent or boutique hotel just is a lot of energy, a lot of effort. And so we spend our time now doing 1 or 2 really great projects a year. And most of the time that's going to be on these kind of call it 4-star boutique hotels.
Having the private equity investment banking background that you do, how do you think about scale in your business and growing your business in the context of maybe only being able to do those 2 hotels a year, which might be really small?
Yeah, sure. So I think as I built this company and as we've grown as a company, my mindset around kind of being an empire builder, it's kind of my term for it, which is just buying as many properties as possible, anywhere as possible, anytime I could find something and work on it. I used to do that. And now what I've learned through a lot of mistakes, frankly, is that I'd rather spend a lot of energy on a couple of projects and larger, typically they are larger or more expensive projects. So I don't think of it in terms of deal, like key count, but in terms of dollar count, like of just like the pure, you know, how much does it cost to develop and how much do the equity return on it? And we're not empire building anymore. So like for us, it's like, it's not fun. Frankly, I didn't find it fun. I thought it was more of a chore. I think it was fun. Like one year we bought a hotel a month or something. It was crazy. Our property a month. And it felt good in the moment. This like kind of like closing a deal. We'd do these little celebrations. And then like a year later, I was like, what were we doing? That was so stressful. Everyone's stressed out. We don't know, like we're running around like chickens with our you know, heads cut off. Like not like, you know, dealing with issues, fires everywhere because we grew too quickly. And it became not fun. And like we weren't good at it. And so I think, you know, what we wanted to do is just like really kind of step back and just really focus on large, and though there were smaller deals too. So it was sort of like, it didn't make sense for us we've been way more successful focusing one project or 2 projects at a time, larger projects, and just enjoying what we're doing and being able to like really curate the food and beverage experience, which isn't easy. So a lot of people ask like, what space are you in? I'm in the boutique hotel space. I'm not in the independent hotel space. An independent hotel is just non-flagged hotel that you like go and you hire some food and beverage manager to run the restaurant. And like, you just have some designer that designs the rooms. And that's, we want a living and breathing property that like has its own mindset. And that takes a lot of energy. It means I have to fly to like Uruguay to meet a chef. And like, I would normally never do that. It's a lot of work. You know, it's a lot of work. I have to like fly them around. I have to meet them in New York or Miami. I have to like go to their restaurants. I have to spend a lot of time with them. And you have to want to enjoy that too. And I just can't do that at a large scale. Like, I don't think so. You know, I don't think I would do it well. And so to answer your question is like, we're being very calculated on the deals we work on. We only do a few a year. But they come with the size. So I don't know if we're necessarily sacrificing much, but I do think that we're gaining a lot in terms of execution, better execution.
We're going through a similar exploration now. And one of the things I think a lot about is you spend the same amount of time on a commodity or undifferentiated asset as you would on a boutique asset. And maybe spend a little bit more on the design, on the touchy-feely stuff on the boutique side. But running the business, dealing with the real estate is a very similar time frame. So I'm curious, like, what mistakes would you tell your younger self or a little entrepreneur that came to you that was on a similar path that you were on to avoid, or at least to think through in his mind or her mind before she went down that path that you went down starting out?
Yeah. So I'd say the biggest one, which is the one that we all hear about, you know, forever in real estate, that every real estate investor talks about, it's over and over again. It's location, location, location. I mean, I think my, you know, my less modest self from 10 years ago would have said, hey, I can buy anything anywhere. I know what I'm doing. I know how to understand fundamentals of any town, any city, anywhere in the country. Why am I, like, I'm not going international. I'm all, you know, we're all US, but I can go and buy out in, you know, any town. But that doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work fundamentally from how at least I could operate appropriately. So buying a hotel or a property in a town where I don't have scale and it's not big enough to afford the right people to operate it locally is just a huge drain on corporate resources. And so I'd say that, you know, focus on, so like, actually, I was having a conversation yesterday with someone and they're like, oh, wow. Like, I thought you were guys were national. I'm like, we are national, but we're really Northeast in California, in Denver. Like, we're really kind of really focused. 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I would have said, Jake, we're all over the country. It doesn't matter. We're going to go to Austin, we're in Miami, we're in Florida, we can go to Atlanta, you know, we're the Midwest. I don't say that anymore because we tried doing that. And like, one, you pay a premium for being an outsider. Two, it's just hard to find labor in a lot of these markets. I mean, frankly, unfortunately, we're a bit spoiled that we work in the biggest markets that have some of the best talent, you know? And so like we have these great talent on the coast, but unfortunately getting them to secondary locations can take a day. You know, like we had one hotel located somewhere and it literally would take a corporate person 9 hours to get to from like start to finish for a small hotel. And I'm like, and that was like a $10 million hotel versus like a $110 million hotel in our backyard in Manhattan. It's like you literally, I'm like, Phil, you can't do that. Like you can do it, but it's not like we have to really think about if we can run this type of operation. So for me, it's location, location, location from the mindset of what is your area of expertise to run and build? And I know a lot of people focus on that, but that's how I would have told my younger self. But two, location, location, location within the locations you want to go. So like, it's sort of like, for me, it's always worked out my best benefit to buy in the best locations, in the best markets. Like it's just, it has. Like when I tried to buy in an up and coming location in a good market, it just hasn't worked out. Like it hasn't worked out as well as if I buy the prime in the prime location, like, even if I'm paying up for it. And so for me, we focus on that. Now we focus on the diamond on the roughs, you know, places that are in incredible locations that need a lot of work. You know, we are turnaround people because that's kind of how we operate versus buying things, something to stabilize. And sometimes it's hard to find that, like try to find a hotel in Aspen, you know, like it's going to be really hard, but that would be like, for an example, that would be a location we'd look for, like the crappiest hotel in Aspen that's asking a lot of money. But like we would do that. That's the type of deal we would do rather than a hotel that's like in 30 minutes out of Aspen. That's like a better property has, you know, maybe has like a much larger, like acreage and like you could do more and it'd be more creative and you could be interesting. I'd still rather do the one in the heart of Aspen. Like for me, it's like, it's location, location within the location. And like, even if it doesn't have the bones to be as nice, I'd rather still focus on it. Even if I'm paying the same per price or even more, you know? So for me, that's something that fundamental basic information, I think I thought I could kind of work around or, you know, outsmart, but it never works. It hasn't worked out that way.
It's so weird hearing you say this because I was having the same conversation and I think surviving COVID, not losing a hotel, I think exactly what you just said, that the specific location within a location is so important. And in a lot of ways, you can weather almost any storm if the real estate is good versus not good. And I would say the other thing that I learned, and I want to hear whether this has played out in your portfolio or other hotels that you've seen, and that's the commodity hotels, I found that there's less levers to pull. There's less things that I can do. And I had a realization that there's a lot of other smart people out there and they're just doing the same shit that I'm doing. And it's just minimal ways that you could differentiate an Indigo from a Marriott Courtyard or another Indigo down the block. Whereas the stuff that you're focused on now, there's so many different opportunities to generate revenue. Is that something you're seeing or is that just a talking point that outsiders talk about?
No, 100%. I mean, I think the thing with me with a branded hotel, you know, like a Hilton or a Hilton Garden Inn or whatever, Courtyard, I think my mindset, and that's why we don't do it. My mindset on those is that you're literally taking Marriott's court, like their playbook. And you're just saying, hey, Marriott, tell me what to do. Like you're taking the entire creative process out of it. So if your revenues are down, you're like, Marriott, what do I do? You know, your expenses are up. You're kind of like, you obviously have to focus on your own expenses, but you're asking them for help. But especially on the revenue generation side, on our creative hotels or boutique hotels, I mean, PR as a strategy and like coming up with creative content and things that drive business is that's our most important. That's what we spend almost every day thinking through. Like, what is it that we could do that's going to drive traffic to our property, drive visibility to our hotel, make it interesting, have people find it interesting? Like, because that's the only way we drive business. It's not just like Marriott doing another ad campaign that helps all the hotels in the Marriott system. It's the Walker Hotel doing a campaign to help the Walker Hotel. And so it's a lot of work. I mean, it is. And that's why it's hard. I found it hard to do smaller boutique hotels. It's, you know, on the one hand, you want to take less risk on something that on something large. But on the other hand, you have to have a budget for creative content and creative creation and frankly, doing things that drive visibility to a hotel that may lose money. You know, like, you know, we do programming that certainly costs me money, but people are going to write about, if that makes sense. Like we know, like, this is going to be cool. Everyone's going to talk about it, but I'm sure we're going to lose money on it. So it's got to be a part of your budget. You know, it's not like, you know, so it's, without getting into too much sauce, but like that's kind of like, you know, in the independent, it's very important. It wouldn't help you with your Courtyard example. No one's going to the Courtyard because some cool influencer is in your lobby, you know, like, or, you know, like it's no one's doing anything. You're going to a Courtyard because, you know, you want to get your Marriott points and it's a convenient location. And frankly, Jake, I was telling this to a friend the other day. I'm like, listen, I don't know. I'm not in that space. If you are a branded hotel person, you might want to think about your portfolio. I was actually with a friend, I was actually 2 days ago, and his family owned a lot, all branded hotels. You know, they're large owners. And I'm like, listen, have you guys thought about what the future looks like? Like the last 50, 60 years have all been identical. The branded hotels have increased. But since the invent of the iPhone and reviews online, which is all relatively new, you don't need that. And in fact, Gen Z and certainly the younger generations, I mean, I don't know who would want to stay at a Courtyard, you know? Like I think that for them, it would be really odd unless someone forced them to stay there. You know, it's not like your customer today that's like, hey, listen, like I'm that, you know, I've been using Courtyard for 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It's sort of like these are people who've never stayed at a Courtyard and have no interest in staying there. You know, they'd much rather stay at an Autograph by Marriott, for instance. And so, like, what do you think about like a Holiday Inn Express or a Holiday Inn or a Courtyard? Not now, but like in 10 years, 20 years, you know, when Gen Z is your customer that's never grown up that way. I don't think they're going to all of a sudden flip when they're 40, you know, or they're 35 or whatever and be like, hey, I'm going to start staying at Courtyards now. Like, that's a conversation, but I've been thinking about that. I'm like, what do these brands think about? You know, like, I don't know. It's going to be interesting things to play out over the next, you know, decade or so.
Well, the brands are scared. I mean, that's why you see Hilton buying Three Lifestyle, you know, the Ned, AutoCamp, or partnering with AutoCamp and then doing Graduate, because they can't really incubate it on their own. And they're seeing that's where the trend's going. And for all of our branded hotels, we really try and think about them as different and unique. But the trouble is, and what I found is that you're essentially just managing with
beta. You're not really creating any extra alpha. And if you're doing that, you might as well be in the multifamily business, because hospitality is just too hard. You invest in a lot of different types of real estate, not just hotels. I'm curious to know how your other real estate portfolio has helped your hospitality portfolio, and how your hospitality portfolio, particularly the creative stuff, has helped the other things you do.
Yeah, sure. And I guess the last point on the other one, I actually think what will happen with the courtyards is they'll become more creative. So I think that's what it'll end up pivoting to. Like, they'll, instead of like everyone having the same soaps, it's like, hey, now at some point, I'm sure they're going to be this whole thing where like, hey, as long as it's a high-end soap of some quality that we approve, it'll be okay. So I think that would probably be the answer, but we'll see. But in terms of, I will say, it's always going to be the hospitality teaching the other products, the multifamily, because the hospitality is the most creative. It's the most interesting. It's the most human, right? It's the most short-term leases. The other stuff is certainly getting there. In office, 100%. Like office, your traditional boring office space. I mean, it's scary what's happening with office around the country, right? It's just because if you have your kind of plain vanilla office space, your class C, B suburban office space with like low window, like little window lines, or even some of the window lines with big floor plates that have drop ceilings. I mean, good luck. I don't like you. You have to like give that stuff away. And it's hard in like suburban office is really, it's all, I remember looking at office buildings long time ago, like 15 years ago in Dallas, in a good time. And like in a good time in Dallas, suburban office, pretty good locations within Dallas. It was like a low margin product because it was like the moment the lease came due in 5 years or 6 years or 7 years or whatever, there was some other office landlord that would basically offer you the full incentive as though you were a new tenant. So you're basically giving all these incentives away, like basically giving a year or 2 years away, free rent and TIs, all this leasing, like you're paying out as a landlord. Your margins are so thin. I worry a little bit about that. And so I think to answer your question, it's the hospitality side that's really training us on the office side of what else can we offer these tenants? It can't be a commoditized space. It's got to be interesting looking. It's got to be concierge services. It's got to be a cool lobby. It's like, you know, it's got to be like, you know, you try to like, you know, offices don't, a lot of office tenants, we're trying this out. If we can get tenants back in the buildings, you know, what we're trying to get is to have our own center core offering event planning for the tenants. So it'd be like you go floor to floor where it's like, hey, you know, we have like, call it like mini golf somewhere that we organize for every tenant in the building as the landlord, because we know that it's easier for us to offer it for the tenants. So they're not paying, each tenant isn't paying their office manager to do this coordination. We are coordinating for 20 tenants, 30 tenants, 40, whatever. It's a lot easier for us to do it. And then we're giving those discounted fees, sometimes free, back to the tenants. And so we're trying those things out. That's something you only get in hospitality. You know, that's in the hospitality space. That's not a traditional office space. But definitely on the design, how space is laid out, people like to work from hotels now because they don't have to go into the office, so they can extend their time away. Like they could say, instead of going Friday to Sunday, they can go Thursday to Monday or whatever. And then they're like, oh, I'm going to work from Friday. I put it in quotes because I don't think anyone works on Friday anymore. In general, in the United States, but like, you know, they can work from the, you know, if they have to send some email out to pretend they're working, they can at least do it from a comfortable place in the lobby. That's fun. It's cafe, but certainly the hotel brand mindset helps the rest of the portfolio for sure on the design, on the services. And even like a lot of times on like the way they can book things on a website, stuff like that, you normally would have never done for an office building.
You created this amazing hotel in Montauk. You have a couple, but the one I'm thinking of is called the Morang. And it's what every hotel guy wants to fantasize about, taking a motel, transforming it into this beautiful asset, and then selling it at a record-breaking price to a big private equity firm. I wonder if you could share with us the story behind the deal, and maybe some insights into some of the challenges, some of the wins, how it all played out.
Yeah, sure. So Morang was called Atlantic Terrace, and it was owned by the same family for decades. Actually, the sellers of it, it was their dad that had owned it, and then they inherited it. And they were getting, you know, I think they were in their 50s or 60s when they sold it. So this family had owned it for a long time. And they had a price in mind that at the time was a high price for what it was. It was like a lower cap rate deal, high price, and very few sales. And the issue with that property for most people to buy is that it was nearly impossible to get a lender on board. So, you know, it was sort of like, it was too large of a size. At 100 rooms, $30 million to purchase for a lot of people to buy as a, like a family. Like, so if it was $10 million, a little easier for some small family to go and put up $3 million, maybe get a personal recourse loan, stuff like that, and buy it. This got to a scale where you needed an actual firm to go and buy it. And so I think that led to our opportunity by having, we don't do recourse loans for the most part, to get a non-recourse lender to come in that believed us, a relationship lender that took a gamble, frankly, because you don't get star comp sets out there. There aren't trades, there aren't sales. And so it's sort of, it was risky from that perspective that you're kind of going in and believing us that we could actually create this business plan, that there are these wealthy customers out there that want to stay, that they're paying these high prices already, and they're staying in really crap product. And then also we saw this kind of, you know, a lot of ways it's luck, but we also saw this kind of mindset shift where, you know, people still do the house shares out there, but it's not as big as it was before. I mean, it used to be for decades, everyone in New York just, you know, got a house share. You split it with 10, 20 people or more. You got your room, you got it. It was like a timeshare kind of situation in Manhattan where people did it. And in a lot of ways, you know, with social media and stuff, people still go out there, but they want the ability to like not have to commit the entire summer. And so will they be willing to pay a premium to just be able to book a hotel room with hotel services two times, one time, last minute? Absolutely. We found that's a trend that had grown a lot when we first bought it. And so that was something that I was willing to bet on, that it was like, was going to continue to grow. And we had seen it, like the rates were crazy out there and even for house shares. And so, you know, we took that risk, we took that gamble, and it was a challenging project for sure, from the mindset of getting it financed, getting contractors out there, because you're competing with contractors that are building super luxury homes for very wealthy people. And so it's like, hey, can you go build my hotel room, even though you're building a hotel room from some celebrity that's willing to literally pay you anything you want? Like, you know, price per foot, that doesn't matter. it's like they'll overpay by millions of dollars just to get it done for the season. That's what you're competing against. So it was a challenge. And it's not like you can get people to come in from other towns because it was such a far commute. You know, we're at the end of Long Island. So it was and then labor is a challenge. And getting labor out there all summer, it's seasonal business. And so there's a lot of things you learn when you're out there that a lot of people don't know how to like navigate. And we learned by trial and error and fire, you know, and so we were able to do it all. But the fundamental mindset there was, there's only very few hotels. So if you're familiar with the Hamptons, you may drive on the coast and see a bunch of places that say hotel on it, but most of them are cooperative hotels. So those are rooms that have been sold to people that have owned it for a long time. So you can't actually access buying those hotels, a lot of those little motels. And because they've been owned by a bunch of people, you'd have to collapse those cooperatives, but it's going to be really hard to do. It may take you years to get every single person to buy. And then like, even if you buy half of it, are you going to really renovate it all when half the rooms are garbage? It's like, it's hard to do, or you're doing it for their benefit. So if, you know, I think when we calculated, there might've only been three or four or five actual hotels on the ocean in the Hamptons. Like literally that's it. I mean, so you literally we had like almost no competition, you know? So it's sort of like, if you buy this hotel, like you would be one of the few that actually was on the beach. There was a couple others that were across from a little road. So maybe it's like beach, but not actually on the beach. And so I'm like, This is gold. This is golden real estate. You know, it's going to be worth something. It's going to be worth $300,000. We ride through. So that's what happened. And, you know, it ended up, it hit it out of the park from the day we managed. I mean, they had no professional management. They had no revenue management. They weren't managers at all. They literally hired some random guy to manage it. One person who wasn't even a real manager. nice guy, but he wasn't like a true manager. He was more of a food and beverage guy that ended up managing it because he was friends with the family for a long time. And so there was all these strategies that they had been left behind for decades because that's how they operated and they were making a lot of money. So why wouldn't they, you know? You know, they had their basis was nothing. And so it ended up being a really great opportunity for us. We ended up selling it to a really great firm. They're really incredible. And frankly, you know, we left money on the table, I think. You know, I think we could have sold it for more. You know, I think that it was a great return for us, though, as you mentioned. So I'm not complaining, but I do think that they, like I said, the fundamental is still there. There's only a couple of hotels in all of the Hamptons. And it's going to always be golden. You know, it's always going to be golden. So I think it's a really special property.
What mistakes did you make in the CapEx and the renovation as you're looking at other projects that you're going to change or avoid?
You know, I think that, as you know, Jake, I mean, in building a property, the focus is, well, obviously cost, budget, it's timing and quality. You know, so I think it's like one of those three targets of the angle of the triangle. For us, we're really hyper-focused. Obviously, we're always focused on budget, but I'd say we're probably more focused on timing. And so for us, getting something done incredibly quick is very, very, very important to us. And so when we set a time frame, we don't let anyone get in our way of our time. And so it's so important to us. Like, it's sort of like, hey, if we're opening on a date, we're opening on that date. Like, I don't care what happens. Like, we will sacrifice everything to get open. And that is a lesson I learned from doing lots of projects that were delayed because we were focused on the quality and the cost. And then we were completely burned by missing the season or our debt coming due or the capital stack costs lining up or like having all these employees. Like, it's like when you do the math, it's like, wow, like this, like the timing for us is the most important thing, the most. And, you know, and so it's like for us, we're hyper, hyper focused on timing. Like, we're going to get something done. And if we say 12 months, it's 12 months. I don't care what we have to, like, we don't care what happened. Like, we have some incredible lights that we ordered that are now back ordered. We're going to Home Depot and buying something equivalent and we're installing it all. And like in the off season, we'll replace them out. Like we will get open. That's not going to be, if we're waiting for someone to get back to us on a design decision or approval, like that's usually on us, but sometimes it could be somebody else. We don't care. We're going to go and do it. Like, it's like, this is the deadline. We got to order it today or tomorrow. If you need extra time to go and run somewhere, to go to a store, to find out, to make sure, blah, 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 I don't care. We're going to order it. Like, it's like you missed the boat. And so now when we work as a team, like it was a little jarring at first time, like in that kind of process of timing being the most important thing for us. But now it's very important. Like I'd say that. So for us, it's focus on timing. Everything is based on timing. Like, we're going to get open. We're going to get open on the date we say, or as close as possible, you know? And then in second is cost. Obviously, cost is obviously the most important thing. You can't go over a budget too much, but we're willing to sacrifice on certain aspects of a project for the timing and cost. You know, we obviously, the things that people touch and feel and look at, we're going to, you know, go to spend the money on that. But there's a lot of ways, as you know, to be creative. There's a lot of ways, you know, when you do, you know, one thing, like if you're doing plaster walls, like if you were to do real plaster walls in a room, like in Milan, we have plaster walls. If you were to do real plaster, I mean, it would cost $10,000 to $15,000, maybe $20,000 a room, maybe more actually. You do that thick plaster that you see in Europe and stuff that was done 100 years ago. Like, I mean, it's a fortune. It might be more than that. Like it's impossible. We tried doing it and we were like, let's do it. You have to like take, so, you know, like you do a much smaller coat, you use a different type of plaster, you get the same look, you know, like it's sort of like we aren't building our own chateau, like where you want to actually do it properly. It's a hotel, you're going to renovate it after a few years. And so like you kind of like start like saying, hey, what can I do that does a similar look that's not going to, you know, break the bank, you know? Like behind you is my office. Actually, it's a good example. Like I'm in my office. That's a door to like a little conference room. That's a metal door, but that's a sheet of metal. So that's not a metal door, because a metal door would have been expensive. That's just it's a wood thing with a tiny sheet of metal. It's like a metal veneer that makes it give you the metal look. That costs nothing, you know? And so like that was super cheap, but it looks awesome. It's great quality and it stays, But that's kind of like how we think through. Like sometimes we'll go off and we're gonna get the waterworks pictures because we know they're gonna touch and feel that. We're gonna get the Lutron system lights. We're gonna do all that stuff. We're gonna buy a really nice, you know, mattress. We're gonna do all the stuff that you touch and feel. But certain things you're not. Most customers don't know. You know, if you're a designer, you might know, but most customers won't know the difference between a lot of the things that we may have to switch out on the costing that we may have wanted to at the beginning of a project. I don't know if I answered your question on that, but that's a.
I love it. How do you think about seasonal properties and your investing style going forward? Because timing is everything. I mean, we were looking at a seasonal deal, and one of the things that scared us was we aren't going to finish the renovation in time for season, and then we're blown.
100%. That's very scary. In fact, in Maram, that happened the first year. We and it wasn't because we weren't done with the renovations. We were done. We were waiting for city approval. Which was scary. So we had to like put a lot of pressure, and they were great. They gave us their approval before August, but you know, we lost all of July, which, you know, so at least we got a month our first year in. But seasonal properties, I'd say at first, I used to be a little scared of seasonal properties. Now I really love them, I mean, personally. So now we know how to operate seasonal properties. We know what to do, how to staff them. What I like them now because, you know, inevitably, any hotel you own, and most of the hotels we own, have seasonality. There's a low season and there's a high season. And in our low season, we lose money. And so because we have staff that you have to keep on board, you can't let them go. What I've learned with these hyper seasonal markets like Montauk, where you're really making your money over 3 months, and you're right, it's scary in that, what if you have a bad 3 months? What if something happens? But what's great about it is I load up my labor in those six months really. And it's really 3 months. And then like, there's like, they kind of trickle in the back, the front half and the back half, but I'm shut down. Like I have no cost. I mean, I obviously have my mortgage and stuff, but I don't have any operating loss. Like, you know, for the most part, like it basically, you know, I have my manager, I have to pay your round and maybe some engineer, but like the truth is that you cut your expenses a lot and you're losing less on all those other months. And you're focused, hyper-focused on that kind of peak season where I can staff up just for the season. And so I've actually enjoyed it. I, you know, we now like seasonal work. And so seasonal business hotels, the hard part is probably convincing a lender, you know, but now we've done it. So we can tell them we know how to do that. But for us, we like it. But I agree on a renovation. That's part of the thing. You have to be super focused on just getting it open, and which can be a challenge. Not on just on your construction side, but probably more on the permitting side. So you might have to make a hard decision.
On the management side, how have you figured out the problem of firing, rehiring, retraining all the staff? Obviously, your GM is the same person, but he's got to show the bartender how to make the drinks, and you've got to redo the culinary program. How does that work in a seasonal environment?
Interesting enough, a lot of the people come back year after year. So it's more of like they're there for the season. They leave and they go to do something else seasonally in the winter. And then they're like, hey, this is a dream job for me. So because inevitably it's a great location for them. They're getting free housing usually, or discounted housing in a resort location. And, you know, they're working 5 days, maybe 6 days, but they're getting a day or two off to go surfing or hiking or whatever it is. And so a lot of the people love it. It's sort of like, there are some new people that come, but a lot of times it's the same people over and over again. That they're just used to it. They're used to it every year. So it's kind of like the same thing over and over again, and it ends up working out well.
That's interesting, because in Europe, there's a culture of that. Like, you know, the waiter in the south of France, you know, goes to like the Swiss Alps or something in the winter, and they keep bouncing back and forth. But I didn't think of it the same way in the United States. And I think that would be valuable for a lot of people to understand. I'm seeing a lot of deals right now where, you know, there's an entrepreneur and people are sending us stuff and they're basically trying to recreate what you did, or they're trying to create a knockoff of Aman Giri somewhere. And they're using some of these major properties as like their baseline underwriting is how they could perform. Even with your success on Maram, how are you underwriting properties in these resort or unique locations where you're giving yourself some margin to not necessarily hit it out of the park, but you can also hit a double and still be very successful. Because there's been some major trades of some incredible luxury assets. And I've been seeing deals where people are just pointing to that as their base case exit point. And in my mind, some of those deals are outliers. So in the deals that you're doing, how are you underwriting to not just have an outlier execution, but something maybe more rational?
Yeah. So I think for us, we're never trying to, not, I shouldn't say never, but right now we're really focused on the 4-star hotel category. So in a lot of ways, when I say 4-star, it gives me a lot of leeway, a lot of leeway. You know, the moment you say 5-star, there's no leeway. Like, you get 5-star, you're talking about Amangiris and stuff. That to me, I look at that and I'm like, I'm going to lose a lot of money. Like, you know, I feel like I'm pretty comfortable right now. I don't need to do a project for my ego, you know, for an Amangiri that's like, I'm going for it all. And because the moment you go for 5-star, like, you're going for it all. Like, you're going for a grand slam. And I agree. Like, that's the only way you could justify the underwriting of a lot of those projects, I think, is by having that kind of outlier return we mentioned. A lot of the projects we do, you know, we don't think that we're necessarily the outlier. We will look at if there are other trades that may have happened that will be above us. And so can we sell, are we getting a really great return by selling it to like 20% below, 30% below, 40% below that high watermark? Is there money going and chasing? Like in Sonoma, we have a resort, but there's a hotel called the Farmhouse Inn that's just 10 minutes away that sold for $1 million something a key. And then there's other resorts in Healdsburg that are going. So like, we can go at half that and make a killing off of our return. In Montauk, in Marom, you know, we sold it at a pretty high price, but Gurney's, you know, I think they had done a refinancing before they were going through a refinancing, and we knew what they were refinancing at. I think the refinancing was at like $1 million something a key, just at the debt level. And so we were like, hey, listen, even for a margin of this, for a margin of Gurney's, we're going to kill it. You know, like we're just, you know, and so like that was kind of like, it was almost like we're trying to stack the deck in our favor. And you can get away with that in the 4-star category. You know, you can't get away with that, I don't think, in the 5-star, because in the 5-star, it means you have a lot of labor. That means all these kind of like things, the tricks I'm telling you on a 4-star, you're not going to probably do as much in a 5-star because your customer is paying a lot and expecting a lot, even though I think people are probably trying to do that now, because it costs a lot to build stuff now. And so I think that like, but it's really kind of the services. I think that in terms of margin, you know, I never wanted to pay the hot potato game, which is how I feel luxury hotels are, where it's like zero margin, like is the zero cap rate going in, you know, or like close to it. And it's always like, hey, you're buying this at 800 a door, $1 million a door, you're making zero, but you're going to sell it for 1.2 or 1.3. because appreciation. And it's like, okay, your rate's going up, but your expenses are going up because, you know, it's eating into all that. I don't know. Like that's why we focus on that 4-star stretching as much to 5-star as possible. Like it's kind of like that balance, what we're trying to do. That's kind of, it's like kind of like buy something that was run down, diamond in the rough, or build it, you know, that becomes harder, but buy something diamond rough in a great location. It's harder to build in a great location. These prime locations usually have a lot of issues, like with building new product. Like in the Hamptons, they hate it. You know, in Sonoma, they hate it. You know, like places like they just don't like new construction. So you usually have to buy something. We have to usually buy something old and like make it as nice as possible. So that's kind of what we've been focused on. But yeah, I Amman is a great example. I mean, I think the joke about Amman is that I don't know if it's ever made money, you know, any of their hotels. So I mean, I'm like, you should always stay at an Amman because they're probably losing money on your stay, you know, because they, you know, look at the staffing model they have there. It's incredible. It's incredible, but incredible hotel experience. It really is. It's a great
100%.
Great place to vacation. I don't know if I'd own it.
we had Homie on the podcast and he'll say like, this thing was basically a once in a lifetime opportunity that he created and it almost failed 10 different times. And it just exploded when it did. And it's not something magical that he did. I mean, I think he's a great designer and a great asset manager. 100%. He really worked with them on to fine tune it, but it's not an outcome that he thinks he can reproduce every time.
I think he's doing something really interesting. Obviously, he's looking at making money by going urban, which, you know, I think makes a lot of sense. I think the issue with what I was getting at before for the decades Amazon's been available is that their locations are so special that it has to cost a fortune to operate, to run on a day-to-day basis. And so that's why I was saying, but if you're doing it in urban city centers, which they're doing now or a little closer to, you know, society, I'm sure he's going to kill it there because, you know, like there's such a brand recognition. I don't know how well they're doing, but I'm sure they're doing really well, you know, in their urban markets. And I think they just came out with that more affordable version, which I think is really smart, where you can graduate to an Aman eventually. So I like that.
Well, they're playing where you are, and that's maybe in the 4-star space. When you're concepting one of these amazing creative hotels, what are like the key components, whether it's service or amenities that you have to have and that are really non-negotiables with you and your team that you're conveying to the design team or the operations team that this is how we're going to do this property?
It's definitely the food and beverage. I think I'd say, okay, so non-negotiables would be, it'd be the food and beverage experience, some level of food and beverage experience that's interesting. So like, I think that like without real food and beverage and, you know, unfortunately the Hamptons were crippled there because the town doesn't let you do more on the food and beverage side. They're actually like, if you ever go to any of the hotels we have out there and you're like, why doesn't they have X, Y, and Z? Literally, I'll say the town of East Hampton. Like they don't allow you to do anything. They don't allow you to do service. They don't allow us to give out forks and knives that are not disposable. So if you go to Moran, they're like, that's the reason why we don't have plates and forks and knives and dinner service and all that stuff and waiter service. It's because the town won't allow us. And so, but that aside, we focus on food and beverage. Like how can we make the best of what we are allowed to do per code, town code? And that's a cool restaurant, a comfortable restaurant, not necessarily the coolest restaurant. We don't need a restaurant that's hard to get into because that's bad for our customer. We don't want to have a hotel like restaurant where like you're a customer of the hotel and you're like, I can't go to the restaurant. That's super cool. Like it doesn't work, you know, like it's gotta be like you're staying at the hotel. You're going to be able to eat there. You're going to go to the bar. We're going to treat you well. And I think that's really important. And the design has got to be interesting. I'm very anti-fleeting design. You know, it's something that just looks really cool without naming brands. Like, I think that like there's some designs out there that I think are really interesting. I'd stay at them, but I'm like, this is not going to age well, you know, like this is going to age really poorly. And when I'm running a hotel, like you can't go wrong by building hotel design that like you don't have to gut in 10 years because you're saving that money. You're literally just saving that you're replacing furniture, not gutting the flooring and the walls and like redoing the bathrooms. It's like, and so I see some of these hotels, I'm like, man, that looks awesome today, but in 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, like you're gonna have to gut this thing. And it's just not worth it. Like, and I don't know if the customer necessarily just doesn't love just like great, interesting design versus something that has to be so loud and bold. And so we don't really typically do loud and bold design. Like, you know, just like, you know, we try to do stuff that's gonna be around for a while. So that's kind of been our focus, things that we can mix and match even in 5 years. We have to do a real renovation. We don't have to like gut the place. And so that's kind of what we think about. In the customer experience, you know, service is really important. It's become more challenging, obviously, in today's hospitality world where, you know, in COVID, a lot of people left the industry. A lot of people retired. A lot of people took jobs in tech. And so I think we're starting to build back that labor force, but it's become challenging to kind of find good labor in real time and then have labor. You know, sometimes we have some people that we can't replace because even though they're not great in the customer service side, because we literally have no one else. So it's sort of like, you know, like we have to hire 5-10 more people. It's like, we can't just get rid of them, even though like, I know you don't like them. Like we see people complaining about this person. It's like, okay, you know, that's been a challenge in our industry, unfortunately, especially when we are hyper-focused on service. You know, that's what we do. Like we're trying to be really great at service because we don't have that concierge. We don't have that 5-star stuff because we don't want to lose money on that. So our front desk agents have to act as concierges because we want to add more to the level of service than just an independent hotel, right? So we want to be able to offer guests the ability to book them some show or get them a car or something like that. You know, we're trying to leeway, like frankly, we're trying to work with technology to do that for us in a better way. But those are some of the things we focus on.
Yeah, I think what you're getting at is there's a ton of value in actually spending in the hard things that people touch and feel, and maybe finding opportunities to save on the service side, which is a recurring expense that happens forever. There's a hotel in New York that I stayed at recently called Nine Orchard. I don't know if you've ever been, but they did a beautiful job on the rooms. You got to check it out. It's like timeless design, which is exactly what you're talking about. The service is kind of this 4-star thing, but the rooms feel like they will never fade out. And the materiality, you know, felt luxurious. It felt high end. And it was almost like if they had 5-star service, it would be a 5-star hotel. And I wonder if that's where you're going and that's where you see the opportunity to kind of invest more in the place and the physical and evolve with the service through time, whether that's more or less or whatever it may be.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a promise we don't want to give people up front because they're disappointed that, you know, that like we're just 5-star, we would always have this. But the moment you remove it, they're going to get upset by that. And so we're always careful about that. You know, always careful about adding, like, do we add this? Because, yeah, it's nice today, but what if we can't, you know, execute on this and then someone gets upset tomorrow? And we actually worry about that. There was actually a few years ago, there was this really great app. It was a concierge app. This was, you know, like 7-8 years ago. It was incredible. It was really great. They literally did everything. They thought it was the hotel, but it was a third-party app that did all this work. They literally texted every customer, booked them everything they wanted. It was so easy. And of course, they went out of business after like 9 months. And I'm like, okay,
yeah, I remember
very
this.
Careful about this. Yeah. Now you'll be very careful about it because it's like, they clearly didn't make any money. But it's like, that was an incredible level of service that I wish we could do, you know, be able to text people in real time, just make them dinner reservations, do everything for them, even though now people could do it on their own. Like, obviously, now everyone could do a lot of these things on their own because there's so many apps. But like, I personally like just dealing with one person. Like, I like it, like, you know, even when I'm going to Paris for the Olympics and there's a lot of Airbnbs in Paris. I actually like staying in Airbnbs in Paris sometimes, but I'm staying at a hotel because I'm in that business, but I'm staying at a hotel because I don't want to deal with stuff, you know, when I'm in Paris, like on vacation, like I'm bringing my kids. Like, I don't want to have to deal with what's going to happen when I'm there. Like, is there someone going to pick up my phone? Because I was asking these Airbnb hosts, I'm like, hey, I need someone to go get groceries for me. If I need like book, they're like, sorry, we don't do any of that. I'm like, you know what? I'm here 5 days. Like, I don't want to deal with it. I want the hotel to deal with it. I want someone who's like local, that knows people locally, that's going to guarantee me a good seat, the reservation, the car that's going to be there on time, because they have scale. They're important to the actual end user. Me as the random person coming in, staying a few nights is not important to that business. So I like using the hotel as the crutch to like make sure that my vacation goes smoothly. It's important to me as a guest. And so that's why I want to be able to offer that to the customer too. Like, rely on the hotel for the best kind of service possible, the best recommendations. And so, you know, we try to do that. But yeah, you can't pull it back. You know, so if you come back to New York and you aren't offered that, you're like, oh, what happened? Oh, now I'm trying to save money. So you kind of tiptoe into it. And I guess, Jake, I don't know. Would you have paid more if you got more service? I don't know. Yeah, I kind of wonder.
I think it's interesting. When I am traveling with my wife and my kids, I want 5-star service because, like you, I want everything just handled. But if I'm by myself on business, I think I want to feel like I'm staying in a more of a residential setting, maybe a high-end like condo or apartment or something. And this is what that felt like, because I didn't need a lot of handholding during my stay. But one of the things that I kind of thought was connected to what you were saying about the rate ceiling is that this is somewhere, like, the location's a little weird of this Nine Orchard, but this is somewhere that my wife would stay and she would still feel like this is a luxurious and high-end experience, maybe less so on the service side, but more on just the physical package. And I think that's a tremendous opportunity because, you know, now you can charge maybe a little bit less than what the 5-star hotel is charging. And then your opportunity is unlimited. It's not capped.
Yeah. No, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, I think that like it's as long as you're getting some level of service and security, I think that, you know, you're probably happy. That's all you need, you know. and you're coming to New York. I was giving the Paris example because I don't speak French, you know. I didn't like want to deal with this. I'd been to Paris a bunch and like, you know, you can get away obviously with speaking English, but not as comfortable.
100%.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the design because your hotels are known for this timeless design. It's really good. A lot of people that say they want to do boutique hotels actually screw up the design. So I'm curious how you approach it, both on the design side and on the branding side. Like, what comes first? Walk us through the process.
Sure. I'd say we've learned over time on how to do this. I mean, I think that, you know, my first time, I'm like, oh, let's, you know, I got a hotel. Let me go hire an interior designer. And the interior designer comes up with a bunch of mood boards. They say, what are you thinking? I'm like, I don't know. Like, I think I want this. And like, you kind of come up with this hotel and then you're like, okay, what's the name of the hotel? It's very much what I call an independent hotel, you know? Now, the way we think about it is way more high level. It's sort of like, hey, why do we want this hotel to exist? What are we looking to achieve? And so we almost go about it in the complete opposite way. We think of design later. It's almost like, hey, why should we build this hotel? So why should we even work on this project? Like, what's the point of it? And the point is, like in Mom, since we were using that, it was meant to be barefoot luxury. You know, that's like, listen, it's like, it's not a Four Seasons. It's a 3-hour drive on a good day, you know, from Manhattan, you know, and now it's a little easier because you can probably leave early or late because, you know, people don't have to go in the office as much as pre-COVID. But like, you know, it's like, you know, it could be stuck in traffic for 5 hours, you know, on a Friday, you know, if you can only leave on Friday for some people, which is a lot of people. And, you know, I think that like, we wanted people to be like, hey, listen, you know, one thing we say is we don't want people to be afraid to drop their fork, which happens out in the Hamptons at certain properties, certain places and certain homes where they're like, everyone here is rich. Everyone's so good looking, like everyone's dressed up. Like, am I an outsider? Everyone has this kind of like outsider approach. We're like, hey, Maram, we want you to be able to come in there, be very, very comfortable. That like, you know, this is a place where you leave your shoes, you know, in your room, you're walking around barefoot. You're not afraid of doing anything. Like, you're just very comfortable. And that's what we wanted to design. Because I'm like, that's what people want in the city. It's like, I don't think people really want to go and like be uptight when they're on vacation. You know, it sounds cool. You know, it might look good on Instagram, but I think it's, you know, for a photo, but I think if you're like actually thinking, it's like, you want to be comfortable on vacation, obviously. And so, you know, for us, it's like, hey, what do we want it to feel like? And what are we looking for? And then we backtrack and you're like, okay, what do you get there? Well, when it was Atlantic Terrace, it had really everywhere we have like sand dunes, it had grass everywhere. Like literally almost everywhere on the property was grass. It was grass, 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 grass in front of the rooms, grass down that below section where we have the fire pits. And we're like, you know what? We want people to, when they drive up to this, we want them to think we built this thing on the beach. And so we removed all the grass. We put in sand dunes. We wanted them to be really large sand dunes in front of the rooms for one, privacy, but also like we wanted, it's a cool look. You drive in. We also had this thing where we wanted to get rid of the concrete and put a wood deck. So like when you're like, you know, taking your bags and you're hearing that click, like click, 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 click of the, of your wheels on the wood. It's like, that reminds you that you're in the Hamptons. We actually wanted to have gravel in the parking lot. So like you're driving up, you're driving on the highway. You're like,
you hear the crunch.
Like, oh, I'm now on the beach. I'm on the beach. The town didn't let us do any of that. But like, that was like kind of the vision, but we got at least the dunes. They didn't need their approval for that. But like, you know, we got the dunes in because that's landscaping, but like they wouldn't let us change out the surfaces. But like, you know, our point is like, this is what you, when you come to that property for this is that, this is what you want. We wanted them to feel like they're on vacation. The moment that they're not stressed out. And so how do we get there? And we thought, and so we really thought of the product and the guest experience first. What did we want to offer? We wanted to offer like this, like kind of, you know, in an ideal scenario, we wanted to have outdoor fire grilled cooking, like where you can actually cook over a fire pit. You can see the chefs. We aren't able to do that for Town Cove. But like, that's why we went to an Argentinian chef that like cooked that type of food in Fernando Troca. And so that was kind of like, we were going to do this whole display when we first thought about it, because it was like just fun and cool and unique and outdoorsy. So we first thought of it that way. And then we thought about what's the design choices that could work. And actually even before that, it's like, why should this hotel exist? It was all the investment choices I told you about. Actually went into the reason why we wanted to make the investment to begin with. You know, it's like, you know, people are spending, like, they want to spend like more time in a hotel room with hotel services. They want to be on the beach. Like, you know, they don't want to commit an entire summer. So like, I think we thought of that as a way to like be able to stay in a hotel. The hotel rates were high. Like, what is an offering we can give them that was a little bit more interesting and unique? Gurney's is a great hotel. We love Gurney's, but it's a big hotel. It's a big convention hotel, really. It does tons of events. Like, half the revenue is from events, like big parties and weddings and stuff like that. And so we wanted a more boutique, unique experience. We don't do a lot of large events at Imaran. It's for the guests. So you want to come in, you don't want to be around 100 people that are for a wedding party. Like, that's what we get at Imaran. Like, that was kind of like, that didn't exist out there. Like, you know, it was really just Gurney's. And so like, so we were like, hey, what's a competitor to Gurney's? Because Gurney's has this incredible location, incredible views, the great beach club, it's all that stuff. What is a little bit of a counterpoint to that, but also you get the same beach and all that stuff. It's like barefoot luxury, very chill, very unique, not a lot of people running around, no events, like not as many events. And so like, that was kind of like our thesis, that what can we do to drive this kind of more leisure customer that wanted a smaller hotel experience, even 100 rooms, but still than that larger hotel experience. And so that was kind of one of the things. And then that led to the interior design last, frankly, and the design that kind of fit what we wanted the property to feel like. And so that took a while to think about. It's like, hey, why should this hotel exist? Why should we do it? And we've killed hotels when we're like, we couldn't come up with an answer why the hotel should exist. We're like, we like this hotel. We like the basis. We think it'd be cool. But there's 5 other hotels that are identical to this in this neighborhood, and they're not selling out all the time, you know? You know, I'm like, and I don't think they are. Like, and so we were like, you know, I don't know what we're doing here. There's no point for this hotel exists the way we shouldn't do it.
So do you create a mood board and this whole story and then give it to a designer or make that part of the hiring process for the designer? Or are they engaged before and collaborating with you?
So there's a guy that we work with, a teammate of mine, his name is Whitney Farr, and he's really our creative director. So Whitney and I do a lot of the work up front. Like, it's well below, before a mood board comes in terms of interior design. It's a 200-page document that talks about exactly what we want the guest experience to look like how, like what we're thinking about, what we want the guest to feel, what we're going to offer or try to offer. Obviously, a lot of it doesn't come into implementation. You know, like, a lot of it's like really cool stuff that we would love to happen, but then, you know, practicality comes in the way. But like, it's like, this is what we want. And it's a lot of work up front. And that's what we start with. That's definitely the start. It's the creative direction. It's like, it's a really creative direction of the property. And that's our first crack at any property that we do. Like that, and that takes a lot of energy and effort. It takes a long time. It takes a month, 2 months to put together, a lot of meetings, a lot of go-throughs. And then we start thinking about the rest. It's like, you know, it's sort of like that's part of like, it's like, now, you know, going back, it was kind of going full circle. Like, yes, like, how do we find like an independent hotel and like the restaurant? Like, what's important? I think a lot of independent hotels would go and be like, hey, you hire like a food and beverage consultant, and they go and say, hey, this is a restaurant, that group that's in your city that's looking to expand, and they'll do a management deal. That's never going to work for us. For us with Whitney, like, we do this creative direction where we're like, hey, what is the restaurant? What do we want the restaurant to look like? What do we want to offer here? And then we go through and say, hey, it would be awesome. Actually, at Imaran, we were like, it would be awesome if we got Francis Mallmann. He's almost like the OG in like open fire grilling in like, yep. South American,
yeah, of course.
And they're like, yeah, like everyone knows him. He had this great thing on Netflix and everyone heard of. And so we talked to Francis, and he was great at the time. And he was actually interested. But then we met Fernando, and Fernando was like, he worked for Mallmann at one point in time, very successful on his own, very known. You know, the thing with Mallmann who's great is that he wasn't going to be there. Like he just had so many great projects around the globe. He's so great that he was like, oh, I'd love to put my name on it, but he wasn't going to like love it and be there all the time because he just had so much going on. Like at that point in his career, he was older, you know? So, but Fernando on the other hand, like was this all in, you know, like could come out all the time, very dedicated, very interested with his partner, Martin. And we just got along really well. I flew to Uruguay. I spent their time there. I went to his restaurant there and in Miami, like, you know, I saw his operations, but that was what we wanted. And that's what we focused on. So that's the point. When we do a hotel, we're looking for the restaurateurs and then we're going and chasing them versus hiring someone and saying, hey, these are available for your property. Because I don't think that fits. And then I think that like can be disjointed. The other thing we do, Jake, just so I don't forget, you said, how do we think about interior design? Is that, and people may disagree with me on this. And most people, I say almost everybody doesn't do this. So maybe we're unique. So we typically have multiple interior designers on our project. So we typically don't have like one interior design firm designing hotel, room, restaurant, bar, you know, cafe. Like Walker Tribeca probably had five different interior designers or four different interior designers. And so we because we didn't want the spaces to all look the same. And inevitably, I've learned that no matter what the interior design there is, no matter how talented they are, a lot of their products all look the same. Like, I mean, like, you know, they are pigeonholed. Like if you go to someone who's like great at modern design and you're like trying to go back to like some kind of like French Art Deco, whatever, and you're like, I like this, they're going to say, yeah, I can do that. Of course. Eventually they're going to bastardize it to look identical to the last 10 projects they did. It's just, they're going to go to what's their natural, what they're interested in, what they know, what they think is good design, you know? And it could be totally great design, but it could be not your design. And so for us, for me, very important that the design looks like what I want, what we want. And so we do a lot of the interior design direction with third-party firms. So like, we don't just give them carte blanche. We're like, hey, we're co-directors on this. We're actually the lead. And so we don't work with larger firms a lot of times. We'll come with up-and-coming firms, usually smaller firms, into people who've spun out of larger firms, because we do a lot of the legwork with them. And we'll work with them on different aspects, and we'll work with other designers on different aspects. That's kind of what we do. That's very important to us. We typically won't hire a big design. No, because at the end of the day, they're going to push their design on you. And like, that's not what we're going to do. And I've actually, frankly, gone to the issue of, I hired a big design firm. I had to fire them because they weren't doing the design I wanted. And it was like, we were starting over again, and we wasted, you know, a lot of money on it. But like, that was the lesson learned. It's like, hey, you hire a firm and they're just going to do what they want, not do what you want. And so that's why we go with smaller design firms, usually up and comers. People are very excited about it. It could be a medium firm that's growing, that hasn't done a type of project that we were doing before. And we kind of push them in that direction. And so, but yeah, that's kind of, we're hyper-focused on that.
How do you make the design cohesive? I get like maybe the restaurant has a different vibe from the lobby and the rooms, but if you're working with different designers for different areas, how do you pull it all together? Or is that what you do? You're the one coordinating and directing, and you just have different creatives maybe tweaking different areas.
That's right. It's a combination of both, frankly. Common areas and rooms are the similar design, but it's more of the restaurant spaces. Like at Walker Tribeca, the Mostrador designer was different than the St. Tuesday, our speakeasy design, that's different than our rooftop design, that was different than who did the lobby and the check-in in the rooms. That was more of the stuff that was a more similar design. So you still got that cohesive look, but St. Tuesday is very different from a design aesthetic. Our speakeasy is very different than our roof. It's very different than our restaurant. It's very different than our lawn. They do all look very different, but they come together really nicely. And that's Whitney and I that put it together.
Having done this so many times, what's the best way to structure a food and beverage deal? Because I'm like you, I'm just like so tired of these celebrity chef things. It's just so lame and boring. But how do you make it work in all the deals that you've done? What's the best way to do it?
So, as you know, Jake, food and beverage business is really tough. It's a difficult business. And the great thing about it is that I'm able to have dinners with a lot of these celebrity chefs when I'm talking to them about being a restaurant. But you're right. It's a one-sided deal. It's a one-sided deal typically where you're going to lose money if you end up going into business with them. Probably. I'd call it 90% chance you're going to lose money. And I think if they're being honest with you, and they never will, they'll say, hey, you're doing this for marketing purposes. And I never believed in that. I never believed that I needed to have X, Y, and Z person as the reason why you'd come and stay at my hotel. I'm not looking to do a loss leader. That's not interesting to me. And so for me, and also the other issue, you know, frankly, with celebrity chefs that have these one-sided deals is that they're worried about their own brand reputation. And so they don't care if you lose a lot of money. They don't care if it's overstaffed. They don't care if you're overspending on stuff. They don't care if you're changing the menu. They don't care if you you're cutting out a menu item that's high margin, but they're bored on cooking because it's bad for their reputation. So we want to cut that away from that creativeness of that person just trying to be creative for the creative sake versus like just having a really great product with someone who's economical. And so what we don't do these types of management deals where it's just a high percent. We manage all our restaurants and we work with good chefs. They get paid, but we're in charge ultimately of everything as it relates to the restaurants. And that keeps a lid on our P&L. That keeps like, we know what's on what we're offering from the food. We know what the product costs are. We know the staffing costs. We run everything. We do everything. And so we've never believed in the management model. So to answer your question more directly, we've never believed in that management model. We've thought it was one-sided. We'd been burned before 10 years ago. And like, I'm like, this guy, they have no reason to like cut it, reining costs. And I'd say it's the opposite. They have every reason to not reining costs, especially when things go bad, because they may think that you're going to go out of business and they're like, okay, I don't want my reputation to suffer. So they may just start pumping up the expenses, but like, or the PR for themselves. So like we, again, that's not, I'm being very, very general, but like, and obviously there's some really good ones out there, but like for us, we've been kind of anti those management deals and we don't do them. And we, for the most part, will focus on kind of like really focusing on the kind of fundamentals of operating the restaurant ourselves and with great chefs, with really great talented chefs that are okay with just, you know, getting paid, but like, you know, not just through a one-sided deal. And there are some really great chefs that understand economics too and are very, very open with understanding that, you know, in order for them to remain in business, they have to. But this, I'm talking about specifically these like larger celebrity chefs or restaurant groups too, not just chefs, but restaurant groups that are focused. And there's some great stories for another day, but I've heard some great stories with some restaurants that you've probably heard of that are like incredible, hard to get into, like lines out the door. You can never, and then you talk to the owner and they're like, we're losing $1 million a year on it. Like, I'm like, it's like, you wouldn't believe it. You're like, how is that possible? But yeah, it's kind of funny.
Or the ones that I'm thinking of, even on the restaurant side where it's standalone F&B, now a lot of people are investing in restaurant deals, not seeing a dime. It's all being sucked out through fees and this, that, and the other thing. Like, well, why did you invest in it? Well, I can get a reservation whenever I want.
It's a club. I've always said it's a club membership. You know, I get friends saying, hey, should I invest in this restaurant? I'm like, listen, dude, like I write it off, just write it off. And it's your club membership. It's your ability to make a reservation anytime you want and get your friends in there and tell your friends about it. I mean, I think that's not a bad investment decision, you know, put in the minimum, like put in the minimum and like, you know, make sure you can go sit there. I mean, and if it happens to be successful and some of them are great, you know, like think of it. I'm like, think of it as a venture capital investment. Like that's, you know, if it makes it, it's one of the 10% that make it, you know, 20% that make it, you'll make a great return, incredible return. You'll probably be up 10x, but if it's not, your downside, at least better than a venture investment, you know, you get to eat there and bring your friends in, which is not invaluable, you know.
It's not. What's the idea for a project or something you really want to be doing that you haven't done yet, that you haven't accomplished yet, in 3 years from now, you'd like to say that you've done?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would love to do a large scale multi-use development. So similar to like, we talked like maybe some housing on it with hotel amenities, maybe a little bit of retail and an incredible hotel, a very like a large master plan community where I can actually direct the thing, but it has to be in a great location. Like I talked about, like in a place that already has demand, but like that would be a dream, a large master plan community where we can build cool houses that have the hotel services that people want, which are larger rooms and like, and be able to offer all these hotel guests and services and sell them out and like put them in a hotel. Like, I'd love to be able to do a large master plan for me. I think, you know, we haven't done that yet. They sometimes can take a very long time. We've looked at some properties like that to potentially do out in California. It can take a long time to do that. That's the one thing is planning and permitting, you know, can take a lot of energy and effort. And so, but that's something that I would love to do.
Especially in California.
Yeah. Especially, yeah. But I would love to do it someday. You know, I think there's a demand for it. You know, there's a demand for having a vacation home that has true services rather than just buying a vacation home or just staying in a hotel. I think that bridged gap is something that could be really interesting. I'd love to do out in the Hamptons, but there's not a big enough plot of land, I don't think, to do it.
No, I mean, I think Discovery Land is probably the best example of someone that's doing that, not necessarily fully into hotel, but it's just amazing what they've been able to curate in so many different properties over not that long of a period of time. It's kind of crazy.
They've killed it. I look up to their development projects for sure. I mean, their projects are great. Baker's Bay, I love. It's one of the best golf courses on the water in Jamaica. It's great. I mean, there's stuff in Hudson. I mean, they do some incredible projects. So I'd say that would be like an inspiration, that those sorts of projects, but with the bigger hotel component. So not just the residential. They have some great projects out there.
I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question. I'm really interested in your answer. What's your favorite hotel? Not of your own portfolio, of something that you've experienced. What's your favorite hotel?
So Jake, there's one hotel hands down for me. Unfortunately, the owner has a little bit of issues, but despite the owner, I'd say it's Chiltern Firehouse in London. And the reason it's my favorite hotel is they treated me like a king. Like they treat me like a king. Like when I go there, the number of surprises that they gave me, like, I mean, I don't know, like, you know, I could have been the biggest celebrity on the planet, you know, like it's like the little things, everyone knew who I was by name. Like you'd walk in there, there'd be a large line to get in, but your hotel guests, they're like, Atit, come on in. Like, you know, like we actually saved a seat at you at the club, you know, it's all pumping, but we saved a seat for you.
Yep.
Like a walk in after dinner. They're like, Atit, you want us to send up a drink up to your room? Like, and like at dinner, like they set you up the best thing. And like one day I walked in, they're like, Atit, like we got something really special for you. Like, do you have 15 minutes? I'm like, yeah, sure. They set me up with this incredible drink, post-dinner drink thing, like at the top of the tower. They did so many things. It wasn't one or two things. It was probably 20 different, incredibly unique things that I remember that like, I keep thinking like, if I could afford to do that at a time, like that level of service, that's the level of service I would give to people. And the vibe they've created for that place is so unique and interesting. To have like a relatively small lobby turn into a very popular lounge and a restaurant that's super popular and a hotel that's super popular. I mean, that's my favorite hotel. Like that's the hotel I stayed at when I was in London. I mean, I love it. It's like a great I get great service there, and I've learned a lot being there because of the level of service they do. But like I said, like, you know, I don't know how involved the owner is anymore with it, but the developer, but he's gotten some heat, you know? And so, but despite that, the hotel itself is what I'm talking about.
You can, I forget what heat, I actually forgot about all that, but the caveat is good, but don't worry. You're not going to get canceled for liking a hotel. It's an amazing hotel. And he has another great hotel in LA, Chateau Marmont, which is, I don't think the service is there as you described, but the sense of place and how you feel is amazing. And I think the way you just characterize that hotel is so beautiful. And it makes me think that that's really the future of kind of luxury experiential hospitality. It's not necessarily how many concierges and how amazing the turndown service is. It's these moments that they created for you. And that's probably the future.
Yeah, it's like making me feel special. I think that was why I liked it so much, is they literally made me feel special. Like, you know, like you go to a Ritz or a Four Seasons, great service. I mean, I'm as special as the next guest next to you. Like they were like doing things specially for me. And I actually have been trying to implement this. We haven't. It's like, hey, listen, we're not going to be able to do that to every guest. You know, we just can't. But maybe we could do it for one guest a day, two guests a day. Like we make them feel super special. Like, hey, you know, like we set you up on this really great place. We set you up on our terrace with a drink, you know, like, do you have a month? Like you see a couple that you like coming in there. Like you put up champagne on your roof that no one ever gets to go up there on your roof. Like you do little things for just one or two people. It takes almost no effort, literally no effort. But guess what? You have a lifetime customer and a lifetime person promoting your hotel And so it's like, maybe you could do this for one or two guests a day, just like making that one or two persons feel special. And that's something that I'm trying to implement, you know, if we can. It's a service thing, but like, you know, because you're not going to make, it's just impossible to make 100, 200 people feel special. So, you know, it's going to be really hard to do that. But on the small scale, you could do it. And so I agree with you. I think that's kind of the future eventually. How do we make people feel special when they come in and not just another person walking through the front door?
Yeah, I love it. I get this picture in my mind. It's almost like this Italian host. It's so much on like finding the right person. And, you know, it's like, if you've ever seen the Studio 54 kind of documentary or whatever, the doorman just knew who to let in. Like he could spot who to let in. And it's not picking and choosing people. It's more making this person feel like they're the king, that they own the room. There's a restaurant in Florida that's an Italian spot, and the food's like a bee. It does insane amounts of volume, but they make people feel like they are the most important person in the restaurant. You know, the maitre d' is in a beautiful suit. Oh, come here. I got this special table for you. Let me dust it off. Does a whole thing. And it's so hard to train. It's almost like you have to find the person to do it. But if you figure it out, let me know and we'll trade ideas.
100%. I mean, I'll tell you, they did that at that hotel at Chilton. I mean, like they literally gave
me a secret table
at the restaurant. They gave me a secret table at the restaurant.
I got to check it out.
The bar. It's really awesome. And when I walked in from the first time, they knew who I was. They knew who I was. I didn't have to say my name. They're like, Atif, welcome. They're like, you know what? We already upgraded you. Like, here's your key. They didn't sign anything. I'm like, this is incredible. Like, it was just such an incredible experience from the moment I walked in to the moment I left. Then when I go there, it's just, you know, that's kind of why because the service was just so spectacular that I'll never forget the service I got. I've stayed at nicer hotels, but that service was just incredible.
I love it. Thanks for coming on the podcast. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Jake. Yeah, great to connect. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.